From KCBW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The filmmaker Richard Dutcher made a splash as the first LDS director crafting movies about Mormon themes and characters that would appeal to a general audience. He succeeded with God's Army, which took in over $2.5 million, not bad for an indie film. But what happens when your personal beliefs no longer line up with your professional identity? For Dutcher, his break with his faith shook up his fan base, his financial backers, and his marriage. Today on the program, Richard Dutcher joins us to talk about making movies, leaving the faith, and his film Falling, which returns to theaters this week. Plus, lupus, and why the autoimmune disease is so hard to diagnose and treat. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Richard Dutcher's film Falling was dubbed the first R-rated Mormon film during a brief run in theaters back in 2008. Falling is back on the big screen this week at the Broadway Center Cinemas here in Salt Lake City, and Dutcher has moved beyond his identity as a Mormon director. Today on the program, we're talking about filmmaking, about losing faith, and pushing boundaries with the director, Richard Dutcher. He's a writer, director, editor, and actor. He's widely credited with launching the LDS cinema movement, and he's made five films: Girl Crazy, God's Army, Brigham City, States of Grace, and Falling. And his latest film, Evil Angel, is an action horror film starring Ving Rhames. It's set for release later this year. And Richard Dutcher joins me in studio. Richard Dutcher, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Falling is back on the big screen through May 3rd at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. There's more information on our website, kcpw.org. Later on in the program, we're getting answers about the mysterious condition lupus. But first, Richard Dutcher, what do you want to know about the LDS cinema movement? If you have questions or comments for the indie filmmaker, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Richard Dutcher, before we get to your film Falling, I'd like to start with the beginnings of film that explored the Mormon experience. You've been called the father of Mormon cinema. What got you interested in telling Mormon stories on the big screen?
Well, the two things kind of came along together. Being a Latter-day Saint and being a filmmaker, up until God's Army, those two parts of me had always felt like they didn't really work together. You know, it's like I could be a Mormon or I could be a filmmaker. I was always battling one or the other. And then, being heavily involved in the independent film scene in Los Angeles, I was working with, you know, filmmakers who were working on various, you know, niche kind of films, whether it was gay films or black films or whatever. And then one day it just occurred to me, it was like, why was I writing about things that were separate from my own experience? And nobody was interested. Nobody was interested in telling stories about real stories about Mormonism, Mormon history, Mormon experience, contemporary experience, faith in the real world. And so that just seemed to click for me. And I realized that if I could make a film that would adequately express my own experiences as a contemporary Mormon, that would probably really resonate with the community, and that there were plenty of Mormons in the world that could support that kind of film. And so I just went off, completely passionately about this. And people often ask me if I was intentionally trying to start a movement or if I was just wanting to tell my own story. And frankly, it was both. I mean, I wanted to tell my own story, but I was very, very, basically I was hell-bent on creating a Mormon cinema, a serious Mormon cinema that would tell the Mormon story and express the Mormon people as they really are, which was something that frustrated me. You know, it was just, I really resonated with Spike Lee, who talked about one of the reasons he became a filmmaker was he was so tired of seeing blacks misrepresented or stereotyped or mocked in the media. And so he started to tell his own stories, and I felt the exact same way. It's like after the umpteenth portrayal of Mormons as basically just these, you know, born-again Christian types, and, you know, completely missed the mark. You know, they just seemed to think Mormons were just like Baptists, and there's quite a difference. And so that was one of my main motivations in making the films.
Did you set out to have a crossover appeal, to appeal not just to the Mormon audience, but to also make it generally accessible to, you know, the general public?
Not necessarily. At the beginning, the first film, God's Army, was very much, I was very much focusing on serving that, the LDS demographic. I thought, you know, they would be the ones, I wanted to tell the story. Well, my attitude, my philosophy at the time was, you know, if I could, I've always believed that, you know, the more specific, culturally specific your characters and your stories are, then the more universal they can become. So it was like I kind of took the Fiddler on the Roof approach. You know, it's like people of all faiths or no faiths can enjoy the movie. Even though they don't understand the cultural specifics, it's the cultural specifics that make the people and the situations, the stories real. So I was basically trying to attain some sort of universality by being so culturally specific, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. God's Army, of course, came out in 2000. It tells the story of a missionary who goes throughout his mission experience while battling cancer. How important was filmmaking to your faith at that point? I mean, you say that your faith informed your filmmaking, and it was kind of this reciprocal relationship between the two.
No, absolutely. That's it. I've always believed. I took my faith very seriously, and I took cinema very seriously. Those were probably, aside from my family, the two most important things to me. And as I mentioned, you know, just a moment ago, you know, I'd always felt like those things had battled each other. But when I finally clued into the fact that I could, you know, through filmmaking, I could actually not only tell my own story, but I could use the art of filmmaking to explore my own spirituality. And then, you know, my spirituality could inform my filmmaking. So instead of making movies about vampires or cute little love stories that take place, you know, in San Francisco or whatever, you know, I was able to find that, you know, the filmmaking helped not only inform, but helped me kind of progress. And I'd say not only, you know, spiritually, but helped me progress as a human being and vice versa. You know, it's like I learned things about my own spirituality through the filmmaking. Ultimately, I learned, you know, quite a bit.
More than you expected. I understand it was during your project, a biopic about the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith, that you really had a crisis of faith. What happened?
Yeah, well, it kind of comes down to another one of my philosophies in filmmaking, a very, you know, principal, primary thing. I always wanted to tell the truth. You know, I always wanted to be truthful, not only, you know, with the performances, with the screenplay, with the stories. I would often stop and say, okay, am I being Hollywood here? Am I just, you know, making stuff up? Or am I really being true to these characters, to this experience, to my experience, to my experience in the world? And I had always, at the same time, I was a student of Mormonism. I was the kind of Mormon that would just read everything. You know, I didn't care if it was, you know, pro-Mormon, anti-Mormon, anything about the history, anything about the doctrine. I really wanted to know everything about my faith. And I had become somewhat of I considered myself, you know, quite the apologist, because I could, didn't matter what problem came up in Mormonism, I had the answer. You know, I could explain it. I could explain it away. And at a certain point, you know, I'd built up this, I kind of describe it as, you know, kind of a house of cards where it was all very beautiful and it was all very intricate. But I didn't really realize how flimsy it was. And at a certain point, when you have all these questions and all these explanations, and at a certain point, it just, when I had to consider whether I was telling the truth and I had to face, you know, the reality, and it just kind of hit me like a, you know, ton of bricks. It was just, you know, hit me that really, for me, the only explanation, after all the explanations that I could give over any particular thing, the only explanation that really made any sense, and the only explanation that I knew in the deepest part of myself was true, was that it wasn't, you know, true. The way I like to describe it, it's like a forest. You know, it's like you take any individual tree and you can explain it away. You know, whatever that tree is, if you focus on that, you can get carried away with the individual trees. But when you look at the entire forest, there's only one thing that really makes sense.
Speaking with the writer, director, editor, and actor Richard Dutcher, his film Falling is back on the big screen now through May 3rd at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us to speak with the father of Mormon cinema, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. You wrote about your break from the LDS Church in a very public way. You wrote an open letter in the Provo Daily Herald. Why did you feel compelled to sort of wear that new spiritual status on your sleeve and make it broadly known instead of just, I don't know, letting keep making movies and let the viewers kind of figure it out?
Well, one of the main things was that I live, I have decided to make my home in Utah. And I began to feel, I mean, it was strange because I was going through a very personal, deeply personal experience and a process. But I found myself, you know, my true self being somewhat at odds with my public persona. And so I would often find, you know, people would come up to me on the street and they would start talking to me about their, you know, how my films had inspired their sons to go on missions. And they would start, you know, in Mormon speak, they would start bearing their testimonies to me. And I started to feel really false. It was like I was playing a part. And I eventually, I mean, this was over a course of, you know, quite a long time. I eventually became very uncomfortable with that, you know, and being asked to speak in churches and being asked to do that. And then something is actually one of the things that really, really clicked was I was at a restaurant one night and I was having a glass of wine because I just felt like having a glass of wine, which was not at all inconsistent with my current beliefs at that time. And I noticed a group of people that were just staring at me and whispering about me. And I realized that my own, you know, that although I was not being hypocritical, I could easily be seen as being hypocritical. And so that was the point when I decided I really need to just, you know, let people know where I am and let the people who, you know, people who had followed me and were very supportive of me as a filmmaker and as an artist, I felt like the only, you know, the only choice, taking into account any sort of integrity that I could do, was just to come out and say, this is where I am.
Hmm. In the midst of all this, you were just finishing the film Falling, billed as the first R-rated Mormon film. Do you consider it a Mormon film?
Well, in the sense that I guess I do, but what Mormon film has come to mean, it's certainly not that. You know, aesthetically, it, you know, basically violates, you know, Mormon aesthetics on every level.
There's a lot of blood, violence. There's some language in there. Probably not the wholesome fare that Mormon audiences would consider to be a Mormon film.
Right. You know what? But basically, I think it's maybe more than calling it a Mormon film, it's definitely an Old Testament film. You know, it's got all the stuff that the Old Testament has in it. You know, it's got the sex and violence and a lot of grim material. So yeah, in that sense, and also in the sense that even though Mormonism plays a as far as being in your face, it's only there a little bit. You get the, you know, you understand that this is a character who used to be an active Mormon. These are two characters that used to be active Mormons. But other than that, you know, it's and I do think it helps if you I think it really may resonate. Well, I take that back. It seems the film as it's screened, it seems like people who have had any experience in any faith tradition really respond to it because, again, it's taking on, you know, universal themes. But even though it's somewhat culturally specific, it's still, you know, taking on some pretty universal experience.
Let's talk about the film. At its center is Eric Boyle. He's an aspiring writer, director in Hollywood. He's paying the bills by filming some crime footage for local TV stations. He's played by you, and he desperately wants that big break. I want to play just a short clip from the film. This is Eric interacting with a potential producer from the film, wanting desperately to have him embrace his script. And here's the producer's reaction.
I used to be a bartender. I ever tell you that? Man, I hated that job. People with their stories, their problems. Now here I am paying for people's stories. It's weird, huh?
I thought you said you liked it.
I do like it. I'm not gonna make it. If I give you money, you gotta give me something I've never seen before. Something nobody's ever seen before. Otherwise, who cares?
Mark, you've never seen this story before.
What are you, deaf? Last year somebody shows blood. This year you gotta show bone. Next year you gotta show inside the bones, whatever that is called.
Marrow.
Right. I don't know what that is. I don't know what it looks like. You've gotta show it to me. Then I'll be shocked. Then I'll be offended. Then I'll remember your name. Then I'll put out 10 bucks to see whatever it is you're gonna show me next.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Something new. That's all anyone wants to see.
Okay.
Richard Dutcher in the film Falling, is that a familiar refrain that you've heard from producers, the something new? Is this a, in some ways, expressing your personal frustration with the movie industry?
Well, in a way, there's a few conversations in the film that were taken, that were such shocking conversations for me that I had, that I tried to write them down as close to verbatim as I possibly could. So this is one of the conversations that is, naturally, I expanded upon it and, you know, sharpened it for the film. But this conversation, there's another conversation that happened in bed with the husband and wife, you know, late at night, and that was, you know, taken almost as closely as I could from the real life conversation and things like that. People have asked me, you know, how autobiographical the film is, and it's like, no, I wasn't a stringer in Los Angeles. I didn't do this for a job, but some of the experience were my experiences, and at least in a deeply metaphoric way, that was my LA experience.
Speaking with Richard Dutcher, the independent film director, actor, and writer, his film Falling is back on the big screen through May 3rd at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. And we're talking about independent film and faith with Richard Dutcher. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. We're speaking with the filmmaker, the writer, director, and actor Richard Dutcher. His film Falling was dubbed the first R-rated Mormon film back in 2008 when it had a brief run in theaters. It's back on screen through May 3rd at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. And Richard Dutcher is with us to talk about the film and about his faith and questions about his faith, how that all informs his art. If you'd like to join our discussion, if you've got questions or comments about LDS cinema or about Richard Dutcher's work, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Richard Dutcher, before the break, you referred to a scene where the character Eric is in bed with his wife, Davey. He's reflecting on where he is in his career and as a person. I'd like listeners to take just a bit of this conversation and then get your response to it. This is a scene from the film, Falling.
I used to be such a different person. I used to pray. I don't even pray anymore. I used to be a missionary. God, I haven't done anything really good in 12 years. I wasted 12 years.
That's the actor Richard Dutcher in his film Falling. It's hard not to think that Eric's thoughts somewhat echo the thoughts in your real life, given what we know about your struggles with spirituality and faith. Richard Dutcher?
Yeah. Was that a question?
Yeah. I guess so. I'd just love to hear your response to that particular scene.
Well, what that scene really means to me is I had always wanted my life to mean something. I think that was one thing that Mormonism, one reason I responded to Mormonism when my family joined the church when I was very young, was it did give you a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, and you know, being able to be a missionary, feeling like you're doing something important, that you're helping people, that it's, you know, and then finding, you know, after that, being feeling like you're without a purpose, you know, especially somebody with that sense, you know, chasing a Hollywood life, you know, trying to, and you find yourself doing things that are just pointless, you know. And my very first film, which was Girl Crazy, you know, I'd spent 5 years getting this thing made and out there, and finally, you know, up to on HBO. And at the end of the process, I was like, I just spent 5 years of my life making a complete, you know, piece of fluff, trivia. You know, it meant nothing. People would watch it and walk away. And that's not what I wanted my life to be. And so that's a lot where that conversation and the real life conversation came from. It's like, what am I doing? You know, if I spend the rest of my life doing this, then I've wasted my life. And that was actually one of the transitional conversations that helped, you know, point me towards this very, very personal kind of filmmaking, where I felt like I was expressing things that at least on film, no one seemed interested in expressing. That was probably a fairly, I don't know if it's a universal experience, but certainly a common experience where, you know, everyone wants their life to mean something. And every artist, you know, would hope that their work would mean something, that would make a difference.
Your critique of the film Girl Crazy as fluff is one that you have given to many in the Mormon cinema genre. You say a lot of these Mormon films are, you know, they're eye candy. They don't really get to the depth of the Mormon experience. Is that where you see Mormon cinema today? Is it kind of in this place where it's either all, you know, the most rosy experience that you could ever have, or it makes light of every element of this unique culture that we know as Mormon culture?
Well, I don't think I ever used the word fluff to describe contemporary Mormon cinema. I think I used the word crap.
Okay.
and that may sound harsh, but what Mormon cinema has become is very, very, very different than what I hoped it would be, what I wanted it to be. And at the same time, I found that it is exactly what it inevitably would be, which is how I've been able to make peace with the whole thing. Because when I first started, when I thought I was creating something that's been known as Mormon cinema, I thought I was sending it off on a road of, you know, exploration, of serious consideration of Mormon themes, Mormon history, Mormon doctrine, Mormon, you know, psychology. And that, you know, died away pretty quickly. And no matter how hard I fought, I mean, there were only so many films that I could make. And as it turned out, I guess I can't even say that. But basically, you know, there was a flood of films after God's Army and Brigham City that came from, you know, Mormon so-called filmmakers, and they were the opposite of what, you know, they mocked the culture. Basically, I felt back to the Spike Lee, you know, analogy. It's like, you know, he's had the same frustration, you know, with people after he kind of broke some serious ground, and then other black filmmakers came in and they were reinforcing the stereotypes. They were, you know, I think I remember him referring to it as, you know, they themselves were performing the minstrel shows instead of you know, the white community. And I kind of felt the same thing. It's like, why, when we finally have the chance to tell our own stories, to tell, you know, the depth of our own experience, why are we doing our own version of the minstrel show? Why are we mocking ourselves? Why are we playing into stereotypes? And yeah, that irritated me, and frustrated me, because I felt like I, you know, given some more time, I felt like the potential for Mormon cinema could be, no community in the world seems very dedicated to serious depictions and explorations of spirituality in film. You know, film has become this kind of comic book expression, you know, artistic expression. And so what I was hoping, you know, was that the Mormon community would kind of rally together, the Mormon artistic and filmmaking community would rally together, and they would be the source of serious introspective spiritual cinema. And that, you know, that's exactly the opposite of what happened.
Speaking with the filmmaker, writer, director, actor Richard Dutcher, his film Falling is back on the big screen now through May 3rd at the Broadway Center Cinemas. 801-355-TALK is our number if you'd like to join us. You had a special screening on last Friday night of Falling before an audience. You probably hadn't seen it with an audience for a number of years. What was that experience like for you, and what was the response to the film?
Oh, well, the response was fantastic. We had a completely packed house, so we had about 300 people, and most of whom had never seen the film before. And I usually, you know, in a film, by the time I've finished it, you know, when I'm screening, I like to sit in, I like to watch from the corner, and then go out and pace in the lobby, and then come back and sit down. But so I started off this screening. I did the little intro, then went in the back and sat down, and expected to get up at some point and pace, but the energy that was in the theater, and I myself became caught up in the film, and so I was there through the entire thing, and it was incredibly. We only had 4 walkouts, which was, you know, about 6 fewer than I expected. I know the film by now, so I know exactly the points in which people walk out, and I always want to grab people when they're about to walk out and say, "Just go back, just trust me. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be worth it. There's a point to this." But there's always some walkouts. And oddly, that's kind of satisfying, too. It's like, you know, if you're hitting people hard enough that they just can't sit there anymore and leave, then maybe you're doing something right.
So you like that uncomfortable feeling.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the film, of course. It depends on this film. Yeah, they're... Well, I think I've become used to it because even in God's Army, I had people, you know, which was a very... It was a PG film. It was pretty mild content-wise. And I still had people offended and walking out. And at first that confused me. And then later I started to take it as, you know, a badge of honor. It was, you know, a point of pride. It was like, how many people can I get to, you know, how deeply can I get inside them until I can get them on their feet and have them walk out of the theater? So I don't know, maybe with only 4 walkouts, maybe I'm not doing my job anymore.
So. What kind of questions did people have for you?
A lot of questions, interestingly, and it's very satisfying, too. Very few people want to talk about the filmmaking, which is something that I love to talk about with this film specifically. But they're all very, I mean, it hits them, you know, it hits them on a really deep level, and they want to talk about their own religious experiences, and they want to talk about what that means. And, I mean, one thing that reminded me of what this film can do is shortly before the premiere, there was an afternoon screening of the film, and some people were in there watching it while I was with my crew setting up all the premiere festivities. And a gentleman walked out and saw me in the lobby, and he came up to me to talk, and he couldn't speak. He just started crying, and then he just wrapped his arms around me and gave me a great big hug. And then he turned away and walked away. And then I remembered, it's like I had forgotten the kind of impact that this film has on some people. And I started to feel a little bit silly about doing the whole Hollywood thing, you know, with the lights and everybody dressing up and thinking, I'm not exactly sure this is the kind of film that you treat that way. But it all worked out great. It was an excellent evening.
Speaking with the filmmaker Richard Dutcher, whose film Falling is at the Broadway Center Cinemas this week. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. And let's go to the phones, and Tom is joining us from Bountiful. Tom, hi.
Hi. I periodically get invited out to Hollywood to interact with the, you know, all the participants in the film industry. I'm just curious. I come to be aware or interact, become friends with quite a few LDS filmmakers or actors out there. For example, Sean Monson, who's a, you know, relative of President Monson, and I think Tom and Becky Nibley. You know, I'm just curious to see what your feeling is with the balance of the LDS film makers in Hollywood. And what they're contributing or where they need to contribute to the depictions of LDS life.
Well, as I've, you know, as I think I've made clear, I'm not, you know, I'm no longer LDS, but I'm still very invested in the, you know, I would love to see the Mormon community come out and begin to tell, you know, I would love to see LDS cinema mature and become what I think it ultimately could become. And so I'm very supportive of that. What I find is the same thing that's been happening for, you know, the past decade or more since God's Army came out, which is, you know, there are numerous LDS, you know, crew members, you know, aspiring directors, very few of them are doing, you know, they're all doing whatever they think the Hollywood system wants them to do. And so they're not really contributing to their own culture and to their own people. And so that's what that's the frustration that I come to. It's like it's, you know, it's great. There's some economic realities, you know, you have to make a living and all that kind of thing. But what I too often see and what's always frustrated me is Mormons not, you know, not getting around to telling their own stories. And so I'm completely supportive of, you know, whoever's out there trying to get stories told. But if a Mormon, you know, if a Mormon artist spends his whole life, you know, basically, as I describe in Falling, you know, if you're just basically the artistic equivalent of Burger King, just, you know, giving the people what they want instead of giving that unique, very, you know, very unique experience that you have to share, then I don't think, you know, they're really doing much of value, other than, of course, supporting their families, which is obviously of value.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. You wrote in your open letter in the Provo Herald that I will always be not only a great friend to the Mormon community, but also one of its strongest defenders. Do you still feel that way?
Yes, I do. Not so much to the institutional church, but definitely to the Mormon community. You know, some of the most wonderful, amazing, sincere people I've known in my life are active Latter-day Saints, and so I'd hope to always be considered a friend to them. And I have no, you know, I have no axe to grind. I'm just continuing on my own journey. Let me jump back quickly to, you know, talking about Tom's question, which was maybe a good way to describe my feelings was, you know, you have these great Jewish writers like Philip Roth or Chaim Potok, and who wrote, you know, very much from their own experience and about their own experiences as Jewish people of Jewish faith or heritage. And you think about these guys, you know, if Potok or Roth had never written from that perspective, if they'd only been out there writing, you know, vampire movies or love stories or whatever, what a great loss that would be to the world, and a great artistic loss that would be to the world. And I feel the same way. That's the situation that I see Mormon, not just cinema, but literature and most art in general, is the Mormons, for some reason, don't have a confidence in their own heritage and their own culture and in what they have to offer. So I see happening is, you know, there may be Mormon Potoks and Roths out there who just aren't, you know, using their gifts, whether they're God-given gifts or whether natural gifts or whatever. They're just not telling those stories that I think the world and the art world in general, the world in general, would benefit from.
What do you think about the Broadway hit musical, The Book of Mormon? It's certainly drawn a lot of praise and criticism. Have you seen it? And what do you think of satire based on the Mormon experience?
Well, I haven't seen it yet. I'd love to see it. Next time I'm in New York City, I definitely want to see it. And I have no problem. You know, I've been criticized before where people are saying, well, you don't think there's a place for Mormon comedy? It's like, no, I don't feel like that at all. I'm a lover of all kinds of films. First of all, you know, if something's a comedy, then it better be funny. You know, if it's not funny, then it doesn't succeed. You don't get any passes just because it's a Mormon comedy. It better be comedy. If it's a drama, it better be dramatic. If it's a romance, it better be romantic. And I don't have any problem with satire whatsoever. However, I find it somewhat interesting that, you know, a lot of Mormons have flocked to this Book of Mormon thing and just fall all over themselves to be okay with it and to celebrate it. You know, they seem so enamored of the fact that someone outside their own community has taken notice of them, which I think is, you know, somewhat of a interesting phenomena. But yeah, I don't have a problem with it. I just, you know, at the same time, is it the equivalent in some way of, you know, a bunch of black people going and, you know, celebrating a minstrel show because, look, it's us up there. It's like, no, it's not. You know, it's somewhat of a representation of us, but it's not the same thing.
801-355-TALK is our number. We're speaking with the writer, director, actor Richard Dutcher about his career and his film Falling. Well, let's go back to the phones, and Tim is joining us from Salt Lake City. Tim, hi.
Hi, folks. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I saw Falling for the first time yesterday, and I was a walkout. I found the violence really disturbing. But in retrospect, it's rather small scale compared to some of the stuff that goes down in the world, you know, in the Balkans, in Africa, in East Timor. So it was just really a dose of realism, you know, what real life is like.
Why'd you walk out, Tim? Just it was too bloody for you?
Starting with the death of that woman, the man's wife, I forget her name. But I just find it disturbing. I find the violence against women disturbing. And it was a pretty ruthless mano a mano fight. You know, I have to leave. But I missed the end of the film, so I want to go probably again and see the conclusion, see the denouement. So.
Okay, Tim, thanks very much for the call. Richard Dutcher.
Yeah, excellent. Tim, yeah, I certainly hope you go back. You missed probably the last 10 minutes of the film, and like I say, that's where it all comes together. That's where I would have grabbed you as you were walking out of the theater and said, just trust me, just get back in there. There's more to this, but I certainly hope you go back and see the rest.
Tim, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. This email looks like it's an anonymous email. Is there any chance that the Joseph Smith biopic will get back on track? The truth about Smith is way more interesting than the sanitized version Legacy that plays on Temple Square. Richard Dutcher, you left the church during the early stages of making this film about the church founder and Mormon prophet Joseph Smith. Any plans to finish that project?
Oh, absolutely. That's unfinished business. It's one of the films that I definitely have to get made before I leave this planet. But the only reason I haven't made the film is simply because the financing fell through for the film just weeks before I was to start shooting, and I haven't been able to manage to pull that money together again. You know, it's a good $12 million for the kind of film that I want to make, $12 to $15 million. And if I had the money today, I'd be shooting it tomorrow. That's how I feel about it. But oddly, that's people. You know, the public really, really, really wants to see this film. That's pretty much every day of my life. People are asking me, "How's that film coming along? Is it going to be made?" I need to get a T-shirt that just says, "Yes, I'm still going to make this movie," and I would love to. Like, if there's anyone out there who wants to help me make it and has $15 million, then meet me outside Library Square here in about 15 minutes. We'll get started.
I guess our time is short, but finally, you have decided to make your home here in Provo. Why aren't you in Hollywood?
I actually hate Hollywood. I lived there for 10, 11 years and came back to Utah and just realized that this is where I want to live. This is where I want to raise my kids. This is where, you know, I want to get up in the morning and see the mountains and breathe the air. I love pretty much everything about Utah. And I've lived all over. My stepfather was a small businessman. We moved all over the U.S. when I was a kid. And I just, of all the places I've been, internationally, you know, traveling with film festivals, and of all the places I've been, I just love Utah. I just love it. And so I plan to be here, you know, till the end.
And your next film, Evil Angel, are you selling out?
Evil Angel, am I selling out? No. Evil Angel was a much-needed break for me because I'd spent all this, you know, several films making these deeply personal, you know, opening up my chest and letting the world see all my insides. And so I needed a break, you know, and I just wanted to do something with lots of stunts and effects and something that was just a fun roller coaster ride. And I always tell, when I speak to college students and people who are interested in making films, I always say the one you should be working on is the one that if you knew you only had 1 year left to live, that's the film you should be working on. And oddly enough, you know, at that point in my life when I decided to make Evil Angel, that truly was just, if I only had 1 year left, I felt like I'd done, you know, some stuff that was, you know, very satisfying. And at that point, and increasingly unprofitable. And so at that point, I thought, you know, if I only had 1 year left, I need to do something to help, you know, take care of my kids, make sure they can go to college. So
what's your next project after Evil Angel comes out this year?
Right, October. It'll come out in October.
Okay.
And after that, I've got an art film that I'm working on called Triptych that I'm just shooting here and there as I get it. It's progressing in its own interesting way. And next month in May 19th, I start filming a comedy called The Boys at the Bar. We're going to shoot it here in Salt Lake City. It's set in St. Louis, but we're shooting it in Salt Lake City. And again, a different kind of film. very satisfying in a different way.
Richard Dutcher, he is the writer, director, editor, and actor of many films, including Falling, which is returning to the big screen now through May 3rd at the Broadway Center Cinemas here in Salt Lake City. There's more information on our website, kcpw.org. And Richard Dutcher, thanks very much for the time and good luck.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Up next, getting answers about lupus. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. An estimated 20,000 Utahns live with lupus, an autoimmune disease that primarily affects young women of childbearing age. Today on the program, we're learning more about this disease and why it's so difficult to diagnose and to treat. Joining me this segment is Noelle Raymond. She is president and CEO of the Utah chapter of the Lupus Foundation. Noelle joins me in studio. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
And the Walk for Lupus, 5K and Run, will be held this Saturday, May 5th, at Liberty Park in Salt Lake City. There's more information about lupus and the event on our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions about lupus, if it's touched your life, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. And Noelle Raymond, let's begin with your own experience. You were 27. You had five-year-old twins. You had this very successful midwife practice. And then you were thrown this curveball. Describe the beginning of your health problems.
Right. Well, for me, and this is not typical lupus progression. Usually it's a long process for diagnosis. But for me, I had not been feeling well for a while, but I think it's easy for women to, especially women, to say, you know, have reasons why they feel tired or why they don't feel so great. And I ignored those symptoms for a long time until it came to a head and I had a stroke and ended up in a coma for 11 days and was not expected to make it. I was in heart failure, kidney failure, lung failure. It attacked my central nervous system, seizures, the whole deal. And I made it. I had to learn how to walk again, went through rehabilitation. It was quite a process. And again, this is not typical lupus. I like to put that out there. It does happen, but it's not the common occurrence. But
And yet the first instinct of your doctors was not to look for lupus.
Right. And in fact, they dismissed lupus when they were going through everything. And it wasn't until they ruled out so many more things that they came back to lupus because it's so hard to diagnose.
Why? Why is it so difficult to pin this disease down?
Right. There's no, you can't go to a doctor and ask for a blood test for lupus. It's a criteria diagnosis. So there's 11 criteria and they want you to have 4. And a lot of them are subjective. A few of them are blood tests. But one of them specifically is an ANA blood test. And a lot of people use that as the major marker for lupus, and it's not a definitive diagnosis, as in my case. That's why they rolled it out, because I didn't have that marker. And but there are plenty of people with lupus who don't have a positive ANA. So, you know, when you're looking at things that are subjective, some of them are joint pain or sun sensitivity. Those are really hard things to pinpoint and to quantify for patients and doctors. So it becomes a really hard thing to diagnose, and they don't happen at the same time, you know, so you're looking over a past of symptoms to try and pull together a diagnosis.
In fact, the disease is sometimes called the great imitator because its symptoms are very similar to a number of other conditions.
Right.
So that makes it even harder.
More difficult, yeah. And typically, studies have shown that it takes 3 to 5 years and 3 to 5 doctors to get a diagnosis. And we get phone calls at the foundation constantly of people who are at the end, you know, of their patients trying to get a diagnosis. They've been to multiple doctors. There is no lupus doctor. You know, there's not a specialist to treat lupus. Typically, people go end up at a rheumatologist, but you know, where lupus can attack the kidneys, it can attack the lungs, you see different specialists. So you have to pull all those, you know, symptoms together and hopefully have someone that's willing to look at everything and make that diagnosis.
So what are some of the diseases that lupus can imitate?
Well, a common one is chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia, because even though they're two separate, very separate diseases, when people go to a doctor with joint pain or, you know, nondescript pain, it's one of the first things I think that they guess. Lyme disease is a big one. Lupus can affect the skin, so there's other skin diseases that they confuse it with. Depending on the symptom, I don't think the whole mimics other things, but when you take each part of lupus, you can, you know, if you have pleurisy, which is inflammation of the lining of the lungs, it could be thought that you have bronchitis, and, you know, not that it's something of a bigger picture.
Mm. About 1.5 million people in America live with lupus. You are guessing that about 20,000 Utahns have it, and many of those patients are young women.
Right. It's primarily women of childbearing age, but it's 90% are women, but we do see men, and we're seeing a lot more children. And I don't know if there are there are more children, or we're just getting better at diagnosing, but it's scary to see the numbers continually rise. And yet, you know, it's more people than MS, cystic fibrosis, cerebral palsy, and sickle cell anemia and leukemia combined in the U.S. who have lupus, and yet we hear about it, you know, so much less than those illnesses.
Speaking with Noelle Raymond, she's president and CEO of the Utah chapter of the Lupus Foundation. There is a 5K run walk to benefit the Lupus Foundation this Saturday, May 5th at Liberty Park in Salt Lake City. More information on the website, kcpw.org. Well, once you finally get that diagnosis, what are the treatment options?
Well, that's the other hard part about dealing with lupus. There is no cure for lupus.
So you can't go in and get a shot or a pill.
No. And until last year, there had never been a medication designed specifically to treat lupus. Last year, the first drug ever designed specifically to treat lupus was approved by the FDA. So that was a huge success for lupus. And it's not a cure-all. It doesn't work for everyone. And it targets a very specific lupus population. But it's, you know, huge steps in forging a cure for lupus. But lupus is treated with non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, steroids. It's treated with anti-malarial drugs. And it's also treated with immunosuppressants. Some are forms of chemotherapy. Others are milder, but they suppress the immune system so it stops attacking itself. But of course, there's all the side effects that go along with suppressing the entire immune system. So sometimes these treatments can be, you know, not worse than the illness itself, but pretty hard to take as well.
Mm. How has it affected your life and just the various treatments that you've had to undergo?
It's hard. I mean, you don't ever hear anyone say it's easy, but I'm grateful that I'm here. I was on, you know, I've probably taken everything that's out there for lupus since I got sick. But one of the things, I was on steroids for a long time, and I gained over 100 pounds from that. And, you know, putting on that kind of weight is never good for your health. And so then you have all the issues of dealing with that and what it does to your health. So it's a roller coaster, and lupus comes in flares too. So you don't know when symptoms will start coming up again. You have, you know, there's things you can, everyone knows certain markers that they watch out for, and they know things might be, you know, not looking good in the future, but it's different for everybody.
Now, the Lupus Foundation supports people with lupus, of course, but also urges financial backing of research into the disease. Are you finding that the research dollars are there, the interest is there to really continue, finding new and different treatments for lupus?
Right. There certainly needs to be more money for research, but since Benlysta was approved last year, I think more people are jumping on the bandwagon. It's becoming a more profitable disease. And, it's sad that that's what it comes down to, but that makes a big difference about who puts money into a disease. So it's improving.
The Walk for Lupus 5K Walk and Run will be held this Saturday, May 5th at Liberty Park in Salt Lake City. About 10 seconds left, but any details that people need to know about that event?
They can go to your website. They can go to utahlupus.org. It's the walk is a one loop around Liberty Park, and we have lunch for everyone. There's a big raffle, live music, and it's a really uplifting day for people with lupus to come together in support of this disease.
Noelle Raymond, President and CEO of the Utah Chapter of the Lupus Foundation. Noelle, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks.
City Views is a production of KCPW News. Thanks to Katie Sheen Abbott. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Tomorrow, it's Law Day. We'll be talking about the role of juries in justice. I hope you'll join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.